This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello?
Marjorie?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to assume we are on the air. This is, there was a technical glitch, but welcome to the People Speak Radio at thepeoplespeakradio.net. This is your host, David Swanson, and we are very privileged to have two extremely interesting guests during the next hour. For the first 20 minutes, our guest will be Marjorie Cohen, who is a professor of law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law out in San Diego, California, and the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She is also the author of a terrific book that everyone should get a copy of called Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. And we may ask her how in the world she narrowed it down to six. She also recently testified before Congress about torture, among other topics, and we are going to be asking her, among other things, about the recent Supreme Court ruling that appears to have restored habeas corpus after its recent demise. And in the second half of the show, our guest will be Steve Heller, who is well known as a whistleblower against the Diebold Corporation and some of its criminal activities out in California, and who has become very active as a leading proponent of fair and verifiable elections. If you want to get in on either of these conversations, you can call in toll-free, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. We'll look forward to hearing from you. If you are outside of the U.S. and Canada, use 877-489-6350. And if you want to send your questions in through our chat room by a text message, go to thepeoplespeakradio.net. Marjorie Cohen, president of the National Lawyers Guild, welcome to the program. Marjorie, are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Can you give me a brief layman's explanation? What is it that the Supreme Court ruled just in the past couple of weeks?
Well, a little bit of background. There have been something like 750 men and boys held at Guantanamo since January of 2002, some of them up to 6 years. None of them have been charged with any crimes. These are not the men who will be charged in the military commissions with crimes, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and I think five other men are facing charges. This is a very different group of people. And so the men and boys that have been held there have been classified enemy combatants, and there is a kangaroo court proceeding, an administrative proceeding called a Combatant Status Review Tribunal, where the government presents very little evidence. There is the detainee does not have the right to see all the evidence against him and does not have a right to present much evidence at all himself. He has no right to counsel. He has the right to a personal representative. And that personal representative can actually tell the government everything the detainee tells him, and so there's no duty of confidentiality. So in these tribunals, these kangaroo courts, they continually get these conclusions that these men are enemy combatants. And in the few instances where they find they're not enemy combatants, the tribunals are told by the military to go back and do it again until they do find that they are enemy combatants. The problem
Can I stop you for a second? Because what most people and most law books couldn't tell you what that means to be an enemy combatant. What's the definition they're going by to figure out if someone is that or not?
Well, nobody knows. That's one of the problems. There is no standard for enemy combatant. And so they declare that they're enemy combatants, and then they hold them and indefinitely with no charges and no right to go into a court before a fair, impartial judge to say, look, I'm innocent. I was picked up by the warlords and sold for bounty to the U.S. military. I've never been on a battlefield. I was in the airport. I was in my house. I was at work. I was on the street. And, in fact, many of these men were picked up by mistake, and the government admits that. There was a study done by McClatchy Newspapers recently, an 8-month study, that found that dozens of men, perhaps hundreds of men, have been wrongfully imprisoned by the U.S. in Guantanamo and Afghanistan and elsewhere on the basis of flimsy or fabricated evidence, old personal scores, or bounty payments. So the question is, how can these men go before a neutral judge, a fair and impartial judge, who will assess the evidence came out at these tribunals and say, look, this guy is being held by mistake. He's not a terrorist. He should be let free. And so the Bush administration has consistently resisted all attempts to let these men go before federal courts to decide whether or not they were properly classified as enemy combatants. In the Rasul versus Bush case a few years ago, the Bush administration made the argument that Guantanamo is on Cuban soil and therefore U.S. federal courts have no jurisdiction. The Supreme Court rejected the Bush argument and said, wait a minute, the U.S. exercises complete jurisdiction and control over its base at Guantanamo, and therefore, under the habeas corpus statute, these men and boys have a right to go into federal court to test the legality of their detention. Then, the Bush administration convinced the Republican-led Congress to pass the Military Commissions Act, and among other things, the Military Commissions Act amends the habeas corpus statute to strip habeas corpus rights from the Guantanamo detainees. So in the most recent case, the Bumi Dien case that the Supreme Court just decided, the issue is whether or not that stripping of habeas corpus in the Military Commissions Act is unconstitutional. In other words, does it violate the suspension clause of the Constitution? The suspension clause of the Constitution, which is one of the only individual rights that the Founding Fathers put into the Constitution before several years later when they passed the Bill of Rights, says that the great writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended except in times of rebellion or invasion when the public safety may require it. Nobody is arguing that we are under rebellion or invasion. And the great writ, which goes back to the Magna Carta, is one of the most important bastions of liberty because it's the only way that somebody who is being held by the government can go in and prove his innocence. So the Supreme Court, in this Bumi Dien decision, in a 5-4 ruling, said that the stripping of habeas corpus in the Military Commissions Act is unconstitutional, and the procedure that the Bush administration had arranged for Congress to pass, once again, Republican-controlled Congress, was not really did not really amount to a habeas corpus type review. The appellate review of this enemy combatant designation was just limited to did that tribunal follow its own procedures, and since the procedures are defective, there's no way that a federal court could actually say, look, there's newly discovered evidence, this guy is innocent, we're going to cut him loose. And so that's what the Supreme Court decided, A, that these men retain a constitutional right to habeas corpus, and B, there is not a procedure set up now that is an adequate substitute for habeas corpus.
So this is pretty big news. This is a fundamental right in our political system from predating our nation for hundreds of years, and our Supreme Court has just been able to reinstate it, apparently. Am I correct in recalling that the Bush administration's lawyers were arguing some time back, in Congress even, that the Constitution may say it can only be removed in such instances, but nowhere does the Constitution say that otherwise you have it, and therefore we can toss it out without violating the Constitution. It seems like such a bizarre twist of interpretation of language that I must have dreamed it.
No, Alberto Gonzalez said that. He said it's not an affirmative right. Of course, you can say the same thing about freedom of speech. The government shall not abridge freedom of speech or religion or press. And so it was an absurd argument that Alberto Gonzalez made.
So the big question now, assuming that absurd argument is done with and that the Supreme Court is supreme, to my mind, is whether the Bush administration is actually going to change its behavior in response to the ruling of the Supreme Court. Because when the president, who was, I think, touring Europe at the time, reacted to the ruling, he sort of stressed that it was a narrow 5-4 split, and he disagreed with it, and so on. And the news stories that you keep seeing are about these kangaroo courts proceeding as if nothing happened. So in what way are they going to comply with the ruling?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, I appeared, after the decision came down, I appeared on the O'Reilly Factor with a guest host, Laura Ingraham. O'Reilly wasn't on that night. And she said the following to me, which was really pretty astounding. She said, "Marjorie, I was trying to think to myself, look, if I were President Bush and I had heard that this case had come down and I'm out of office in a few months, my ratings, my popularity ratings are pretty low, I would have said at this point, that's very interesting that the court decided this. But I'm not going to respect the decision of the court because my job is to keep this country safe." That's what she said. She basically advocated that Bush not follow this opinion by the Supreme Court. Well, Laura Ingraham, who is a lawyer and in fact was a law clerk for Justice Clarence Thomas, should know that the Constitution gives the president the duty to ensure that the laws are faithfully executed. That's one of the duties that the president has. And so when the Supreme Court makes an interpretation of constitutional law, that's the supreme law of the land. But of course, the Bush administration is trying to get around this. And I think one of the first things that they did was to say, well, we need time to add new evidence to these enemy combatant designations and make other changes to the evidence, and we're going to call this factual returns, basically asking for a last-minute do-over before they get to court. And one of the lawyers, David Reams, who represents many of the detainees at Guantanamo, said it's sort of an admission that the original returns were defective. It's also an admission that the government thinks it needs to beef up the evidence. So I think we're going to see that. I think we're going to see them release a number of people rather than have federal courts scrutinize what these kangaroo courts have done. And I think eventually you're going to see the closure of Guantanamo, whether it's a McCain or an Obama presidency. The problem is, and the National Lawyers Guild has been calling for years for the closure of Guantanamo. We've called it a concentration camp, and other people have as well. But the question is, are they going to release these people, charge them with crimes, or are they going to send them to the secret CIA black sites, where they hide them away from the Red Cross and then torture them at will? That's a real concern.
It's a very serious concern. We are speaking with Marjorie Cohn, who is the president of the National Lawyers Guild, and who recently testified before Congress about torture and other issues. She is the author of numerous articles on these topics that we've been privileged to post at my website, afterdowningstreet.org, and that show up on websites all over the Internet. And again, I highly recommend her book, Cowboy Republic, 6 Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. If you want to get in on this conversation, you've got 10 minutes left to do so. Call in toll-free 888-228-4494, as Steve has done from San Jose. Steve, welcome to the program with Marjorie Cohn.
Santa Fe, Dave. Santa Fe.
I'm sorry, San Jose. What did I say?
No problem, bud. And thank you, Ms. Cohen, for all that you're doing. Thank you. You know, the question I've got is kind of current. Wexler, Senator Wexler, is wanting to bring Rove into the Senate investigation, and he's refusing to do so. And this all kind of comes together. What do you think of the legal precedence of him doing so? Mic's open. Or, excuse me. I'll listen on the website. Thank you.
Well, Steve, when the Bush administration doesn't want someone to testify, and this has been several times, they say, oh, that's a privilege, that's executive privilege, because there were conversations with the president or with the executive, or somebody's part of the executive branch. I think that when these claims of executive privilege are eventually tested in court, they will look at the case of U.S. versus Nixon, where Nixon refused to turn over the tapes, the infamous tapes, which implicated him in the Watergate scandal, Watergate burglary, etc. And in the U.S. versus Nixon case, the Supreme Court said that unless we're talking about national security, the president cannot refuse to turn over documents just because they were communications that the executive had with other people. And that's basically what it said. So I think that some of these claims of executive privilege, perhaps most of them or all of them, are going to fail. The problem is that there's a lot of time that passes meanwhile. Fortunately, this Congress has capitulated to Bush, even the Democratic-controlled Congress. One of the things, important things that the Congress has been doing since it was taken over by the Democrats was to hold hearings, and I think David referred to the May 6th hearing where I testified about torture and accountability for torture. There have been other hearings last week, I think it was. There were two very important hearings, and then there's going to be an important hearing tomorrow in the House Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, where John Yoo is scheduled to testify. David Addington has been subpoenaed. David Addington is Cheney's right-hand man, and David Addington is really the mastermind behind the torture memos and other illegal policies of the Bush administration. He has been subpoenaed to testify. My guess is that he will not show up, and they will claim executive privilege once again.
Marjorie, there's a lot of interest, a surprising amount of interest I'm hearing from activists going to their Congress members in the past couple weeks about precisely this issue of defying subpoenas as an impeachable offense. This was Article 27 of Congressman Kucinich's 35 Articles of Impeachment, Article 8 of which, by the way, drew on your testimony before Congress and on international law and on torture as a law that cannot be changed by any nation. The congressman is considering introducing 30 days after he introduced those 35 articles, some 65 articles, around July 9th or 10th, and he'll be adding in not just things that had been left out, but new offenses and new evidence and new crimes. And I'm wondering whether this apparent reluctance to obey the recent Supreme Court ruling will amount to a new impeachable offense, and at what point in time we will be able to say, oh, they're complying, or, oh, they're obviously defying it. I mean, can they proceed with the kangaroo courts, as you call them, for weeks and months without it becoming apparent whether they are defying the law or not? Or at what point can we say there's a new crime?
Well, there are, I think, 211 petitions for writ of habeas corpus pending right now by Guantanamo detainees. And so we can look and trace what happens to those petitions. Do they go to the federal courts? Are they heard in the federal courts, and what do the courts do? Or does the Bush administration try to come up with some kind of abbreviated procedure to get around the ruling? We don't have many months left in Bush's term, so, you know, they could stall. But I think that, you know, these things don't happen overnight, and it's hard to say exactly at what point we could say that they're actually violating this ruling.
Well,
but I think
we need to
trace these petitions and see what happens with them.
Well, we will do our best and look to your advice. We're getting a ton of questions in through the chat room at thepeoplespeakradio.net. Basima in Michigan, if Bush actually gets impeached, and presumably even if he doesn't, what will the chances be that he will be prosecuted for war crimes or presumably any other crimes, or at least brought up on criminal charges?
Well, that's a very good question. Barack Obama has said that if he is elected president, right at the beginning, he's going to look at the evidence of criminal behavior and see whether an investigation is warranted. I believe he will do that. However, I don't think that he is going to want to start out his presidency with what could be bringing them to account, but what could be perceived as a witch hunt. And I'm not saying it would be a witch hunt, but I'm saying, you know, he wants to unite, not divide. He wants to be bipartisan. So I'm not sure that that's really going to happen. But we will see. If John McCain is elected president, I don't think there's any chance that Bush would be prosecuted for war crimes. And who brings prosecutions under the U.S. War Crimes Act? The Attorney General brings the prosecutions. And, of course, the Attorney General now, Michael Mukasey, walks in lockstep with his boss, Bush, so he's not about to do it. Now, let's say that a future Attorney General, say in the next administration, refuses to prosecute. Then what is likely to happen is something that's already been in the works in some countries, and that is other countries prosecuting our leaders for war crimes under the well-established principle of universal jurisdiction. This was used by Israel to prosecute, convict, and execute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they had no direct relationship with Israel. And universal jurisdiction, which is something that the United States uses as well, says that certain crimes are so heinous, they're crimes against all of humanity, and therefore any country can punish them, even if the suspect and or the crime have no direct relationship with that country. There have been attempts to hold Bush and Rumsfeld and other leaders accountable in some countries such as Germany, France, Canada, Spain, and I'm sorry, Brussels, Belgium, and so far none has actually stood up. And one of the reasons is that the Bush administration threatens these countries. For example, when Belgium was going to bring charges against Rumsfeld for torture and war crimes, the Bush administration threatened the government of Belgium with withdrawing the headquarters of NATO from Brussels. And so they backed down, dropped the charges against Rumsfeld. But this is going to happen increasingly. There are going to be other countries. The war, especially the war, which is illegal, is unpopular all over the world. And so there may well be some charges against Bush and Cheney and company under universal jurisdiction.
Well, we've got to let you go, but very quickly, our guest on this program tomorrow evening is Vincent Bugliosi, who's advocating state or local prosecution for murder. What do you make of that approach?
You know, that's fine if prosecutors will bring those charges, but I don't know that that's actually going to happen. I mean, we'll see. The more likely, I don't even know if likely, but I guess perhaps more likely would be that the Attorney General bring charges. But again, there are a lot of political reasons why that might not happen.
Well, Marjorie Cohn, we very much appreciate you lending us a little bit of your time from your very busy schedule, and keep up the tremendous work.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it. You too.
Thank you. We have been speaking with Marjorie Cohn, who is the president of the National Lawyers Guild. She is a professor of law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, California. Her book is Cowboy Republic, 6 Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. And you can Google her name, Marjorie Cohn, C-O-H-N, Cohn, and find a wealth of information. She is one of the leading experts on how the law ought to be used domestically and internationally. And we were privileged to have her on the program, but she had to run. Our guest for the second half of the show this evening will be Steve Heller, a whistleblower who has exposed all sorts of wrongdoing by the Diebold Corporation and become an activist and an expert on how we can get actual, verifiable, credible elections. We're going to have to take a few-minute break. We will be back with Steve Heller and your phone calls and questions. You can call in toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. Anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio. Back after this.
Got questions? the library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. Economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit sosmorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio. You can go and text us your questions as we're speaking at the PeopleSpeakRadio.net chat room, or you can call in free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. Outside of those two countries, 877-489-6350. This is David Swanson, and we are very privileged to have with us for the second half of the show this evening Steve Heller, who is an activist and an expert on verifiable, credible elections and what we need to do to get them, and who, to my knowledge, originally became involved in this effort by becoming a whistleblower about some crimes that the Diebold Corporation was involved in California, and he'll tell us about that. Steve, welcome to the People Speak Radio.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be with you.
It's terrific to have you here, and we also need to talk about some related articles of impeachment that were recently introduced by Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and where those are going, if anywhere. But could you give us the background? I know many people listening may know the basics of your story, which has been told by many writers and filmmakers, and I have seen a great account of it, I think. You can correct me, in the film Uncounted. But
absolutely,
tell us
it's a terrific documentary.
Yeah, I thought so too. How did you come to be on bad terms with Diebold?
Well, this started actually in January of 2004, which, as you can tell, would be about 11 months before the 2004 election.
Right.
And I was working as a word processor at the law firm that represents Diebold in California. And as part of my job, I saw documents about their client Diebold, the law firm's client, Diebold Election Systems, that provided irrefutable proof, smoking gun proof, that Diebold had been and was planning to continue using illegal, uncertified software in their California voting machines. I have no doubt they were doing the same or similar crimes in other states, but these documents were only related to California.
And what happened?
Well, I had a choice to make. I am a person who, having worked in law firms for many years, and also I'm the son of an attorney and the brother of two other attorneys, I understand how vitally important attorney-client privilege is to our legal system. And I had to make a choice between breaking attorney-client privilege, which is a very serious crime, and exposing what Diebold was doing, which I think was also a very serious crime, a crime that strikes at the heart of our entire republic by messing with our elections. So I had to make a choice, and the choice I made was to steal the documents and expose them in the press and to the Secretary of State. And I did that by giving them to Bev Harris of Black Box Voting. And Bev had contacts in the press and with the Secretary of State's office, and she got them to the right people.
So then the documents show up in the Oakland Tribune and so forth. And what happens to you?
Well, what happens to me is that I eventually get charged with three felonies. And I plead guilty to one felony count of unauthorized access to a computer. And I had to pay restitution to the law firm, and I was lucky enough to avoid jail. The charges carried a potential of up to 12 years in state prison. But because I'd never been in trouble with the law before, I was able to avoid jail, and I remain on probation as we speak. But in the meantime, the Secretary of State of California at that time, Kevin Shelley, due in large part because of the documents that I exposed, decertified Diebold touchscreen machines from the state. He called their behavior despicable. And he said, if that's the way they're going to do business, they can't do business in California. So I did commit a very serious crime in breaking attorney-client privilege. That is nothing to be taken lightly. But I did what I felt I had to do to protect my democracy, and I sleep well at night. What is illegal is not always wrong.
That can't be said enough, and it strikes me that if you expose wrongdoing, cheating of the people of California by a corporation, and in response the government of California takes action and tosses out the contract with that company and says you were cheating us, then your action ought to fall under the heading of whistleblowing, and you ought to be rewarded rather than punished for having taken that risk. What am I missing?
Well, whistleblowers never get rewarded, and blowing the whistle often leads to a lot of personal and financial problems to a person. But one thing my lawyer told me was that if I had been a Diebold employee and I had seen these internal documents at the company rather than from the law firm, if I had stolen the documents and exposed them, I certainly would have lost my job, but I would never have been charged with a crime. It was breaking attorney-client privilege that made the difference, and I have to try to look at it as objectively as possible. And to me, if I'd been allowed to break attorney-client privilege and walk away without accountability, that could have weakened attorney-client privilege just a little bit, and we can't let that happen. Now, related back to articles of impeachment, I think other people that break the law, even the president, also have to be held accountable, because otherwise you weaken the Constitution, which has been violated. So just like I broke the law, maybe it was in the greater cause, but I had to be punished in order to protect attorney-client privilege. George Bush has broken the law by violating the Constitution and a number of other statutory laws. He also needs to be held accountable through the power of impeachment.
Well, I think it's quite admirable that you can see the bigger picture in that way. It sounds to me like there may be a few things that perhaps it would be very hard to weaken, and those might be the spines of some of the people working in Diebold who could have exposed these crimes without suffering the way you did. There have to be some people in the mid and upper levels at Diebold who would not have been risking hunger and starvation and mortgage failure, and who understood the criminal actions, and
yes,
yet who failed to blow the whistle.
Well, that's true, and there's no question that they did know about it. These documents made it very clear that their lawyers had told them and were telling them what you're doing is against California law. And Diebold's response in these documents was, okay, you budget for a criminal defense in case we get caught, and we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep using this illegal, uncertified software, and we're going to keep actively lying to the Secretary of State about the use of this software, as well as lying to the taxpayers and the voters who use it. Now, one thing I'd like to point out, this did have real-world consequences. There was a primary in California in March of 2004, and I had stolen these documents and exposed it in January of 2004. The same software was used in March, and it melted down in Alameda and San Diego counties. Machines, the voting machines, shut down. And as a result of that, over 40,000 voters could not cast a vote on Election Day, March 2004, because there were no paper ballots and the machines weren't working due to this faulty, shoddy, illegal software. So this isn't just an esoteric thing of somebody sitting in an office talking about what might happen. This was real-world consequences of 40,000 people who showed up to vote and could not cast a ballot. Not that their ballots were cast and not counted. They couldn't even vote because of this crappy illegal software and because there weren't paper ballots. Now that's a serious crime against the very essence of our democratic republic. And something like that, I just can't believe that it's allowed to go unpunished, but yet it has been unpunished.
And so there have been no criminal charges or penalties for individuals within Diebold involved in knowingly breaking the law. They've simply lost the job with California.
Yes, the Secretary of State, Kevin Shelley, recommended that the Attorney General file criminal charges against them, the State Attorney General. And the Attorney General decided that he couldn't file criminal charges. I don't know on what he based that. But he did join a civil suit that Bev Harris and her colleague Jim March had filed against Diebold. The state joined that suit, and Diebold settled out of court for $2.6 million, which would be about the same as you and I being fined $26. They wrote a check and walked away clean. No accountability. No punishment other than writing that check for $2.6 million, which, again, to Diebold is not very much money. So it was very frustrating, but that's the way the system works, or rather doesn't work. Depends how you look at it, I guess.
Well, I hope some of that $2.6 million goes to hire some good people to publicly count paper ballots on election night in the open. We invite your phone calls to this conversation with Steve Heller, who is a whistleblower to be applauded and who should not have been punished and should not be on probation. I would name some other people who should be on probation. Mm-hmm. You can join the conversation toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. Otherwise, outside of the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350. Basima from Michigan is on the line. Thanks for calling in, Basima.
Thank you, David. And hi, Stephen. Stephen, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you. You are the face of America, and it's unfortunate. I swear, we need more brave people like you. When you contemplate the type of repercussions that have could have come into your life due to your actions, and still you went through it. That reminds me of the America that I believe that we are losing, and I am still so proud that people like you are with us. My question for you is, about 5 years ago, there was an investigation shortly after the election of Diebold, and there was a congressional hearing. At that congressional hearing, the creators of Diebold actually testified that they not only believed that they were corruptible machines, but that they were corrupted. I'd like to know, has anything been done to follow up on that investigation? Is there any kind of correlation between the investigations and the work that people like yourself, whistleblowers, are doing to help change what we believe is a corrupt system of voting? As a matter of fact, just the other day, I believe, I'm trying to think which state it was, whatever it was, there was a school survey that was done, a study, and students studied and found that there were over 6,800 dead voters that voted in the last primary election. And I believe it was Connecticut, if I'm not mistaken. So it's happening. It's still going on.
Well, in terms of what's being done about crooked election systems or just shoddy, badly made election systems, it's a state-by-state thing, and it's kind of hit and miss. Here in California, you have Deborah Bowen as the Secretary of State, and she seems to have a good understanding of how serious a threat to our democracy this is. And when she took office, she instituted a top-down review of all the election systems used in the state and has outlawed Diebold touchscreen machines, except in very limited circumstances when it's necessary for people who are blind or physically impaired. So if you look at California, you're in a good, you're in a better and improving situation. But other states are still using the touchscreen machines, which have been proven time and time again to be inaccurate and badly flawed and to create inaccurate and flawed results. And then you have other states, for instance, New Hampshire. Now, New Hampshire uses all paper ballots, and that's a good thing. But their processes and procedures for how the ballots are counted are still very secretive, and the chain of custody in terms of the ballots, which is a very important issue, that's also left pretty much up in the air. And you have a video taken by Bev Harris and her people from Black Box Voting of ballot boxes leaving one location after the polls closed and arriving at another location, and the videotape shows that the boxes were opened in on the trip sometimes. And the security for these boxes is often just tape. They tape them shut. And we have video, or Bev Harris has video that's been posted at her site and on YouTube, showing the van being loaded with these boxes, then the van arriving at the central tabulation location, and the boxes have been opened in transit. Why were they opened? What was done? We don't know, because, again, there's chain of custody issues that are just being ignored. So it's very complex. It's state by state, and there really is no one answer to what's being done. It depends on what state you live in.
We are speaking, by the way, with Steve Heller, whose story is told very well in the movie Uncounted, and you can go to uncountedthemovie.com and get a copy and watch it and invite all your friends and talk about this, because the media is not talking about it enough in any state, I don't think, even in California.
That's true.
But there are states working toward systemic solutions, and there are people pushing Congress and pushing the media with ideas for solutions to solve this problem, including repealing the perhaps misnamed Help America Vote Act that gave us these DRE electronic voting machines.
Yes.
And very interestingly, of the 35 articles of impeachment that Congressman Dennis Kucinich recently introduced, two of them dealt with election fraud.
That's correct.
Steve, could you give us a brief? I know it took Congressman Kucinich 5 hours to read the articles on the floor of Congress. Could you give us the synopsis of these two and what you think of them?
Sure. Well, one is called, it's number 28, and it's called Tampering with Free and Fair Elections and Corruption of the Administration of Justice. And that article goes into some detail about how the elections under the Bush administration have been willfully manipulated with charges, false allegations of voter fraud. The idea that there's whole bunches of people who aren't registered to vote showing up to vote. And according to a study by George Bush's Justice Department that was released in April of 2007, there is very, very scant evidence of any voting fraud going on. There is electoral fraud. But in terms of voting fraud, it is very rare that someone who is an illegal registered voter actually casts a ballot. And the other one is Article 29, immediately following 28. See how that works? 28 and then 29. And that one is entitled, let me see here, where is that? I'm sorry to hold on. Conspiracy to Violate the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And that article goes into a lot of detail about crimes that were committed, for instance, in Ohio, crimes committed by Ken Blackwell, who was Secretary of State of Ohio and their chief election official, and who was also simultaneously serving as the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign in Ohio. That was very convenient for George and Dick Cheney, wasn't it? And this article goes into some detail about the confusing rules about how to register to vote, the dearth of voting machines that were given to inner city neighborhoods that vote heavily Democratic, the purging of the voter rolls. Over 300,000 people from Ohio were purged from the voter rolls, and the way they did this, they take names that were similar to those who should have been purged under the law, say a convicted felon, if the guy's name was Tommy Johnson. All Tommy Johnsons or Thomas Johnsons or T. Johnsons that were on the voter rolls were purged. And so these kind of sneaky, insidious methods were used to try to prevent Democrats from voting. And it's Jim Crow. It's not Jim Crow of the old days where you've got a country sheriff with a big belly and a gun outside the polling place glaring at black people. This Jim Crow wears a suit and tie, and he smiles nicely, and he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir, you're not on the voting rolls. I can't let you vote." It's the same thing, it's just a different style, but it's still Jim Crow.
It's amazing to look at these articles of impeachment, which have been extremely well documented, and there are books and films and lecture series and all sorts of government studies. There's you know, on Article 29, there's a book by the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, on these crimes.
Absolutely.
And yet it's like a meteor from outer space hitting the Capitol for someone to introduce these things as articles of impeachment. And as far as we can tell, Congress is not jumping on them to act immediately. The first one that you mentioned is I think especially surprising that nobody's jumping on it, because it seems so obvious that, you know, a party, a politician, someone with a stake in their livelihood and their mission in life in stealing an election might take some risk to steal an election. But an individual who's going to risk years and years in prison just in order to put in their one vote for somebody, and or to put it in twice, it seems incredible to me that would be happening on a massive scale.
Well, it's not happening on a massive scale, and that's why it is incredible. And as that Article 29 goes into some detail, I'm sorry, 28 goes into detail about that they're, again, I'm not saying voting fraud never happens, but it's extremely rare. And again, Bush's own Justice Department did a 5-year study from 2001 through 2006, and it was released finally in 2007 in April. And they found, by their own phrasing, scant evidence of voter fraud. It does happen, but it happens very rarely. And in those 5 years, they prosecuted about 80 people, 80, not 800 or 8,000 or 8 million, but 80 people for voter fraud. Most of those cases were thrown out for lack of evidence, and they ended up with a small handful, a couple of dozen convictions. That's over a 5-year period. And yet at the same time, you had Diebold, who in November of 2004 in the national election counted 50 million American votes, and they were found to be using illegal software just a few months earlier from the documents I exposed. So voter fraud isn't really much of an issue, but the Republicans love to beat that drum, and that enables them to pass these voter ID bills. The intent of these bills, they say it's to prevent voter fraud, but it's not. It's to prevent people of color and elderly and impoverished people who often don't have the necessary documentation from registering and casting a vote. The theory is, with most national elections being very close, just a couple of percentage points difference, if you can shave a couple of percentage points off the Democratic voters, then you'll win the election. If you can, instead of, you know, 75% voters, you can only get 72%, then you're going to win that election, because that 2-3 percentage point will swing it your way. And that's the insidious new Jim Crow, which we need to go after as aggressively as we went after the old Jim Crow with the poll taxes and the cops intimidating voters. It's almost better to have it the old way, because you could see it. you could see that nasty sheriff standing outside the polling place with his gun threatening people as they come up to vote. And the ACLU could go down and make a fuss. But these the vote caging and purging the voter rolls behind closed doors and in secret, you don't know what's happening until you show up at the polls and surprise the place where you voted for the last, you know, 10 elections, you can't vote because you're not on the rolls.
Or you see it in a different, less violent and dramatic way, but you see it when the Bush administration's so-called Justice Department does the things listed in Article 28 of those articles of impeachment, which is not just claim that there's voter fraud out there, but actually threaten to fire and fire U.S. attorneys, top prosecutors in the Justice Department, who won't prosecute the stuff sufficiently or won't prosecute particular prominent Democrats or will prosecute prominent Republicans, which of course they should not be doing. And since these articles were introduced just recently, there's a report that came out from the Inspector General at the Justice Department that it's not just the top prosecutors. They've been hiring all their staffers at the Justice Department based on their political ideology, their partisanship. Are they Republicans? They should get the job. Are they Democrats? They shouldn't. So if you turn the Justice Department into a branch of the Republican Party, you start to see some visible signs of that, right? As long as the media reports on it.
Yeah, well, that's a big if the media reports on it. But you're right, the Inspector General of the Justice Department itself came out with this report, I think it was yesterday, maybe the day before. And as you said, they were very blunt, scathing, saying that under John Ashcroft, the choices of who was hired as attorneys and as interns was taken away from career people whose job it had been to do that and was given to Bush loyalists who instituted these loyalty criteria in order to get hired. And under Abu Ghraib Gonzalez, as we call him, this program was expanded even further. And you had people who were rejected no matter how qualified they were if they had been a member of an environmental group. Oh, that's it. Get rid of them. We don't want them. If they were a member of a racial equality group, get them out of here. We don't want them. And as many people have been calling it, it's the Just Us Department, not the Justice Department. And these are the kind of things you see in banana republics, where the people who are supposed to be enforcing the law are crooked and in league with the powers that be. In Africa now, you've got this guy, Mugabe, who's a horrible, violent criminal, who's responsible for countless human rights violations, and he's just refusing to get out of there, even though the election went against him. And it's the same kind of thing that's happening here. The people who are in charge and who are enforcing the law are in league with the top lawbreaker, which unfortunately right now is the President of the United States. He's not really the president because he was never elected, but he's the person who was inaugurated. And that's a terrible shame, and it's a threat to the very structure of our entire republic.
Very well said. I want to ask your advice on what people can do to change this situation, but I want to go back to a question that came in through our chat room for you from John from Canada,
okay.
Question for our guest Steve Heller. Mr. Heller, knowing what you do today, would you have done anything differently in this matter? Congratulations for the courage of your convictions, pun intended. And he is asking, of course, about whistleblowing
right.
at Diebold.
Well, thanks for the question, John. And let me just say, Canada is a very beautiful country. I've visited a few times, and I hope to go back soon. But in the meantime, no, I wouldn't do anything different. I sleep well at night. I made a choice, and I don't regret that choice. There were times when my wife and I were very frightened. We almost lost our house. We were afraid that I was going to be sent to state prison. And, you know, I'm in my mid-40s. I'm not terribly out of shape, but I'm not very big or strong. And prison for me would be a very, very dangerous and bad experience. And I was very frightened of that. But in the long run, no, I wouldn't do a thing differently. I did what I had to do. And I don't want to get too over the top here, but my dad and the uncles on both sides of my family fought in World War II. And they fought for our freedoms. And in 2004, when I stole these documents, that was the 40-year anniversary of three civil rights workers down in Mississippi being murdered by the Klan on a dark road at night because they were registering black people to vote. And I'll tell you right now, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on the radio, but I will be goddamned before I lay down and let these people do what they've been doing without at least trying to stand up and say, no, this is wrong, you stop it. People have given their lives for the right to vote, and I'm not going to let these sons of bitches, whether it's the government or Diebold or anyone else, just take that right away from us. I'm not going to do it.
So assuming that other people are inspired by what you're saying, as I am, what can people do who aren't sitting on a pile of criminal evidence to expose?
Yeah.
What is pushing for impeachment right now the top priority? Is pushing for volunteers to go to polling places? Is pushing for legislation at the state level? What is it that people can do at any level of risk and sacrifice? Where should we put our energy?
Well, in my view, in terms of electoral integrity, going to the polls and being a poll observer is one of the best things you can do. And bring your video camera. And you can get information about what exactly you want to do if you go to Bev Harris's website, that's blackboxvoting.org, or if you go to Brad Friedman's Brad blog, which is bradblog.com, and you can get information about what you can do, how you go to the polls, what to look for, and urging you, yes, bring your video camera and get this stuff on record. And being a poll watcher, actually volunteering on election day to work the polls is also a good thing to do. That way you can see what's going on and you can try to make a difference in that way. In terms of impeachment, yes, I believe we should be pushing for impeachment. I know many say it's a waste of time because it probably won't happen, and they may be right that it probably won't happen, but I don't think it's a waste of time. It's never a waste of time to push for justice, to reach for justice. Even if you come up short, you didn't waste your time by trying. And also, it's important now that we've got in the congressional record, which is sort of the official record of the United States, we've got an enumeration of some, not all, but some of the crimes that George Bush and Dick Cheney and their administration have perpetrated upon our nation, upon our Constitution, upon our civil rights and liberties, torturing prisoners, these kind of things. This is a very serious crime, and we should be pushing for impeachment, and even if it never does happen, we can stand proud and say to our children and our grandchildren, when they attack the Constitution, young fella and young lady, I, your dad or your granddad or whatever, I stood up, and I did what I could. And even if we came up short, I tried, and there's a lesson in that. As Martin Luther King said, the arc of justice bends slowly. I'm sorry, the arc of the universe bends slowly, but it bends toward justice. And that's what we need to be pushing for. So you can go to those websites I mentioned, and also a website that I work at as a blogger is the Election Protection Strike Force, which you can find at velvetrevolution.us, velvetrevolution.us. And there's a lot of information on there about what you can do. That's an activist website. And it's nonpartisan because these are nonpartisan issues. Yes, I'm against George Bush, but it's not because he's a Republican. It's because he's violated the law. And that's a nonpartisan issue, and Velvet Revolution is a nonpartisan site, and you can find information on there about how you can get active in election integrity and in a lot of other issues as well.
Well, Velvet Revolution is a group that also pays the bills to host my website, afterdowningstreet.org, and I never thank them enough. So by all means, go visit and support velvetrevolution.us. And thank you very, very much, Steve Heller, for your time on the program this evening. We've got to let you go and hope to have you back on in the future.
Well, I appreciate that, David, and I want to thank you. I know you're short on time, but just real briefly, I want to thank you for all you're doing, which is just an amazing amount of stuff you've got going on. I'm very proud to have a chance to have spoken with you, and keep up the good work, my friend.
Same here. We have been speaking with Steve Heller, who ought to be receiving awards, not convictions, from our society. We've got some changes to make. You are listening to The People Speak Radio. You can go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and give us your money, because that's how we put this program on the air. And if you do, you will hear in the upcoming days, tomorrow evening from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Vincent Bugliosi, author of The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Should be a very exciting conversation. Next Monday, June 30th, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, wrestler and Navy SEAL, and the author of a new book, Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. And Tuesday, July 8th, John Dean, from the Nixon administration, whose latest book is Broken Government, and whose past works, among my favorite, perhaps, is Worse Than Watergate. Upcoming, those shows on the PeopleSpeakRadio.net. This is David Swanson. Look forward to speaking with you tomorrow night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.
Mm-hmm.